Our reading this morning came from the third chapter of Daniel. Every couple of years, teach a course in Daniel and Zechariah at school, and we had just come upon that. And as we were going over this third chapter just this past week, it occurred to me that there are a lot of lessons in this familiar story. I say familiar story. Most of you probably grew up in some circumstance where you learned the story of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. One kid reported it, Shadrach, Meshach, and to bed we go. I guess it was a bedtime story. His mother read him or something of that nature. But we know how Nebuchadnezzar set up his great image in the plain outside of Babylon and commanded that all of the governing people in his administration should be assembled there to come, and they were going to play the music. And at the point when the music played, all were to bow down and worship the image which he had set up. But of course, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were not going to do that. Somebody always asks me when we study this, where was Daniel? And my answer is, Daniel was back in chapter 2. Daniel's administration was in the royal court. This was an assembly of all those that were governing the provinces, the territories that were part of this Babylonian empire. And, of course, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had been given such positions governing parts of the provinces. And so they are ones that have been assembled to this on this particular occasion along with all of the rest. And when the music plays and no doubt wave after wave of people bow before the image, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego are not bowing. They are still standing there. And, of course, Nebuchadnezzar has them brought in. Actually, some people called Nebuchadnezzar's attention to them. And so they are brought before Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar, angry, infuriated, and unable to believe that anybody would dare to defy his order, says he's going to give them one more chance. And he's going to play the music again. And if they don't bow, then they will be thrown into the fiery furnace. Whereupon, of course, they give that famous reply, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up. And we know the rest of the story, that they are indeed thrown into the fire, a fire heated in the biblical idiom, 10 times hotter. I don't think anybody actually had a thermostat measuring it, but they fired it up as hot as they could get it and threw them in, so much so that those who had dared to get close enough to throw them in were burned. And yet they, in the midst of the fiery furnace, were not burned. Indeed, Nebuchadnezzar, somehow able to see into this furnace, we're not sure exactly how it was made, but Nebuchadnezzar, as we know the story, looked and saw a fourth person with them, some sort of divine being. And he, of course, then has them brought out and is overwhelmed that their God has indeed been able to deliver them, and even pronounces in the 28th verse a blessing. Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and has delivered his servants who put their trust in him, violating the king's command and yielding up their bodies so as not to serve or worship any god except their own God. Well, that's the story that we are familiar with. Faithfulness in the midst of challenge and deliverance by God on behalf of those who were faithful to him. And yet with that crucial understanding on the part of those who were faithful, that God didn't have to deliver them. And they were still going to be faithful, even if he didn't on that particular occasion deliver them. It is indeed a powerful story. And I want to go back through it this morning and look at some other lessons that I think we might find in particular application to ourselves, our own circumstances in some ways. So I invite you to come back to the beginning of the third chapter. Nebuchadnezzar, the king, made an image of gold. The height was 60 cubits and its width 6 cubits. This is a strange sort of statue in some ways. It seems disproportionately taller than it is wide, and there have been a lot of suggestions about it. It reflects in the very dimensions the culture of Babylon where this took place. They used the system of numbering by sixes that we still use today in things that have to do either with time or astronomy, where everything is in multiples of six or sixties and so on. That's actually a little bit of cultural inheritance we have from the Babylonians. If you're reading some translations, they'll convert that into 90 feet by 9 feet, which misses the point entirely. This was just the perfect image in their society and their culture, despite its narrow height. It seems to me almost certain that this must have been, unlike the image of chapter 2, which was apparently the image of a king, the image of a god. Perhaps Marduk or Bel, one of the chief gods of ancient Babylon, but the image of a god that was to be worshipped. Understand, however, that even if this is the image of a god, it is Nebuchadnezzar's god. And to worship the god of the king is a matter of loyalty, if not to the god, at least to the king. Because there was a very close identity between the king of an ancient kingdom and the god or gods that he worshipped. Indeed, many people have suggested that what was really going on this particular occasion was a sort of a loyalty test. We can't be sure about this, but one writer made the observation that this may have occurred shortly after a rebellion had broken out and eventually been quashed there in Babylon. We do know that took place. We do know that that had its influence on the Jews who were already captive there in Babylon, including Ezekiel and his group that we read about this morning. There was, in fact, a prophet back in Jerusalem by the name of Hananiah, who in the aftermath of that started prophesying that God was soon going to overthrow Babylon. All the captives would soon be home. And the prophet Jeremiah had to say to him, no, we're not going to be home anytime. Y'all are not coming home anytime soon. That they're going to have to endure 70 years of the Babylonian captivity. Well, it may be that in the aftermath of that rebellion, Nebuchadnezzar had just this assembly, basically as a sort of a test of loyalty for all of those administrators of the various provinces of this Babylonian empire, reaching as it now did from the Persian Gulf to the Mediterranean Sea. And having them all brought there basically kind of made them take an oath of loyalty, put them to a test of loyalty. Will you bow? Will you submit? Will you acknowledge that I'm your king and this is your God? And again, to the ancient mind, those would be one and the same thing. If that's the case, it is even possible, and I find this an extremely intriguing thought, though I can't say it's certain from the Bible, that none other than King Zedekiah, the king of the Jews at that time, may have been among those. He was, after all, a Babylonian appointed governor, king there of the Jews that still remained in the city of Jerusalem. And the text is pretty explicit that all of the governors and rulers of the various parts of the Babylonian Empire were to be assembled on this particular occasion. We actually have reference to him making a trip to Babylon at just this time period in the immediate aftermath of that rebellion in Jeremiah chapter 51 and verse 29. Doesn't say why he went there, just said he went there and mentioned somebody who came with him. if he was there, apparently he bowed. And I think that may be instructive that this was not simply a matter of every Jew would naturally have refused to bow. It may well be that their own king was there bowing at the very time Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were standing up. We make a mistake sometimes if we think that it's always easy for all of God's people to do the right thing. A lot of times, even God's people are not doing the right thing. And somebody among God's people has to say, no, this is the right thing, and this is what I'm going to do. And that's what these three men did. I think we might also add that as the writer of Ecclesiastes says, a threefold cord is not easily broken, that there is strength in having a brother or sister, someone who shares your faith and your conviction, to stand with you when you have to stand. Sometimes you may have to stand alone, as Daniel himself did later on in Daniel chapter 6. But even in such a time of testing or trial, what a strength it is to have somebody who will stand up with you. Well, in verse 2, it says, Nebuchadnezzar the king sent word to assemble the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the judges, the magistrates, and all the rulers of the provinces were assembled for the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. In some ways, this is kind of a strange chapter. It is one of the most repetitive chapters in all the Bible, particularly here in talking about all of these governors and prefects. And we're going to see the same thing with regard to the musical instruments as well. There was one famous stage actor, British, I think, whose name I don't recall, but upon being asked to do a dramatic reading from the Bible, chose this particular chapter of all chapters. It would never have dawned on me to pick this chapter. But he had noticed all of those repetitions and the way he read it. I think probably he really had the right idea that there is suggested by this a certain oppressive power being exercised by a monarch who will have everything regimented according to his will and everything done just the way it should be done. And so they all come. And in verse 4, says, then the herald proclaimed to this great assembly, to you the command is given, O peoples, nations, and men of every language, that at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the lyre, the trigon, the psaltery, the bagpipe, and all kinds of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king has set up. Notice especially at the end of verse 4. The command is issued to peoples, nations, and men of every language. Sometimes a Bible incident, even a familiar story, may take on a larger significance if we put it in the larger context of the Bible. This is taking place in the city of Babylon, from which Nebuchadnezzar is the most powerful king in the world at that time. Nebuchadnezzar, who, as I think we see in Daniel chapter 2 and chapter 4, but we'll not turn to those chapters right now, really had visions of himself as King of Kings and Lord of Lords, of establishing a sort of utopian kingdom. And the fact is, mankind has always been looking for some glorious, lasting, perfect utopian kingdom. Sometimes kings get the vision that they will establish it. I think Nebuchadnezzar had that vision. I think Alexander the Great had that vision. Maybe Napoleon from our day. Often these are people with warped minds who imagine establishing a great kingdom that will rule the world and bring glory and power to them and peace and prosperity to the world. I suspect Hitler had some sort of visions of that in his own way. Sometimes it's not particular individuals, sometimes it's movements. Certainly the Marxist movement had the vision of a utopian world that would be established. And perhaps in our own society, we imagine that democracy will bring the utopian perfect society to this world, a point in which we are increasingly frustrated as we try to bring democracy to some small country that doesn't want democracy, whatever else. But it is the nature and character of man, and I think of Nebuchadnezzar, to think that somehow we can build this perfect utopian society. And Nebuchadnezzar is in the process of doing that. He rules the biggest chunk of land in the world that anybody rules at this particular point. And it is a kingdom that is forged by bringing peoples and nations together from all of the different territories that he had conquered. Jews and Moabites and Canaanites and Aramaeans and Mitannians and Hurrians and a whole bunch of others that most of us have never heard of. But they were the kingdoms of that day. They had all been brought together in this great kingdom. It is almost like he is trying to reverse the effects of what occurred here at this same city some few thousand years earlier. This is Babylon, remember? The first great city we meet in the Bible, where man in his arrogance was going to build the great city with the tower reaching up to heaven, and where God reached down and divided them and confounded their language. And mankind has been divided and divisive ever since, and been longing to establish some great utopian society that will bring everybody back together. And Nebuchadnezzar seems to think he is on the verge of doing that. And so the herald to all of these people, O peoples, nations, and men of every language, I would suggest that the kingdoms of men will never bring the utopian society, the perfect world that people are looking for. They will, despite trying to find it and thus witnessing to man's longing for something better than this sin-cursed world, they will inevitably end up destroying the very thing they seek. And what strikes me is the similarity of this phrase, O peoples, nations, and men of every language, to what we see in Acts chapter 2. When on the day of Pentecost, there are assembled Jews, devout men out of every nation under heaven, but speaking all of these different languages. If you want to find the reversal of the Tower of Babel, don't look to any earthly human kingdom or king. Look to the gospel of Jesus Christ, the message proclaimed there on the day of Pentecost, the gospel of salvation that can bring unity because it transcends the division of men. I think that's probably why the miracle of tongues was used at that time, again, reversing the effect of the Tower of Babel. And I'll tell you where you see this phrase again in the Bible. It's in Revelation chapter 5, when Jesus appears before the throne of His Father in heaven to receive His kingdom, the kingdom we now join in the body of Christ. And we are told that the heavenly host around the throne of God there sang and hymned His praises, saying, Worthy art Thou, because Thou hast taken Thy throne and Thy great glory and hast reigned over people, and You have redeemed to Yourself out of every nation and tongue and language. It's in Christ that we'll find this kingdom that will bring men together, not in people like Nebuchadnezzar or the kingdoms of men. But that's the order, that they are to fall down. And in verse 6, But whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into the midst of a furnace of blazing fire. And so in verse 7, Therefore at that time, when all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, the flute, the lyre, the trigon, the psaltery, the bagpipe, and all kinds of music, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language fell down and worshiped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. For this reason, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and brought charges against the Jews. I suspect they were waiting for them, perhaps saying, Wow, what an opportunity. Because many of the native class of Chaldean wise men bitterly resented the position that had been given to Daniel and to his friends Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And seizing the opportunity, they come to Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 9 said to Nebuchadnezzar the king, O king, live forever. You yourself, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, the flute, the lyre, the trigon, the psaltery, and bagpipe, and all kinds of music is to fall down and worship the golden image. But whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into the midst of the furnace of blazing fire. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the administration of the province of Babylon. I think this is to the credit of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Not just that they stood up, but that apparently these people anticipated that they might stand up, that they might refuse, that they had lived in such a way that it was their very righteousness that made them suspect. Well, there are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the administration of the province of Babylon, namely Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have disregarded you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image which you have set up. I say that is to the credit of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We might say, well, how could they? I mean, you just couldn't ask for a more blatant violation than to fall down and worship this image, for a more blatant violation of the very principles of the law of Moses and their religion. Well, I suppose I could just practically say, well, most of the Israelites, for most of their history, didn't have any trouble violating those commands. But even more to the point, let's assume that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego have in their heart resolved that they will never worship another god. You realize how easy it would be to rationalize on their part. We say, they couldn't do that. Oh, no, no. Any reasonably clever person could figure out all sorts of ways to rationalize their bowing down. Take Paul's principle about eating meat sacrificed to idols, you know. Can you eat meat sacrificed to idols? He says, we know what an idol is nothing. Well, they can say, I'm not worshiping an idol. I know that's just a stack of gold there. It's not an idol. It's not a god. And there's nothing wrong with being on your knees. I mean, that's a sign of humility. You know, everybody's bowed down. I can bow down. I don't have to worship the god. I'll just bow down, but I won't worship. You think somebody couldn't think like that? There's actually an interesting story. One of my students brought this up when we were talking about this in class. There's an interesting story about Naaman. We all know Naaman. We preach about him a lot, you know, in terms of being baptized, being immersed. When Naaman went back to his home country of Syria, he prayed a prayer to God, and he said, now, God, when I go in and have to bow down before the statue of my king, please forgive me ahead of time. I mean, I paraphrase a little bit, but you think you couldn't rationalize that way? That you couldn't say, well, I'm not going to actually worship the image, but I'm going to appear to. I'm going to let people think that. And if they think that, well, you know, that's their problem, not my problem. All kinds of ways we can rationalize. There is hardly any sin that we can commit, including such an obvious and plain sin as this, that we can't rationalize, that the human mind can't say, in this time, in this circumstance, it would be all right to do this. But they didn't try to escape. They were willing not simply to be righteous, not simply to be faithful, but to be seen to be righteous, to be seen to be faithful. How many times do we find ourselves in some circumstance surrounded by unbelievers where, no, we are not going to participate in the evil, but we are not determined to be seen to be righteous. We're going to be righteous, but we don't want to put ourselves in a position where it will be obvious that that's what we're doing. Well, that's what they did. And they are, I think, a model and a strength and encouragement to us. Well, Nebuchadnezzar is super enraged at this point. And so he orders them brought in. Now, that's interesting because the command had been whoever didn't do this was immediately going to be thrown into the fire. Great people like Nebuchadnezzar, they're not incapable of giving people a second chance, of having a certain graciousness of heart. And so he's going to give them another chance. I can't believe you would do this. And I think we do have to understand this is unimaginable for Nebuchadnezzar. Time slips away from us so very quickly that I won't really elaborate upon this. But the world will never understand faithfulness and commitment on the part of God's people. Peter would say in 1 Peter chapter 4 and verse 4, they think it's strange that you do not run with them in their evil practices. Same excess of riot, the King James wording of that is. In this particular case, understand that to the pagan mind, all gods were valid. Nebuchadnezzar didn't disbelieve in Jehovah, the God of Israel. He believed in him. He just believed he must be a junior, low-level god because he'd let his people be captured by him and his gods. But the idea that there was one god and that had to be worshipped to the exclusion of all others was simply mind-boggling. It's incomprehensible to the pagan way of thinking about deity. I think this has some relevance to our circumstances. Because if there is any God that is especially set up in our current society and religious matters, it is that all gods are acceptable. Sort of the principle that all religions are acceptable. And the modern mindset that finds it inconceivable that you should say that somebody's religion is wrong. Everybody has religion. All the religions are true. They're all good. All the gods existed in the ancient world. Their problem was that they didn't believe in this or that god. Their problem was that they did believe in all the gods. And that's why Nebuchadnezzar, this is just inconceivable. The Jews were actually called atheists in some circles in the ancient world because they didn't even have an image of their god, and they said all the other gods were false gods. They said they're atheists. They don't believe in the gods. It was mind-boggling and inconceivable. And in some ways, it's a fairly simple thing. You're all going to get to demonstrate your allegiance to the king by worshiping his god. And that might not be your god, but nobody in his right mind would deny that god represented by that statue existed. Who in the world would find that? Who could possibly do that unless he wanted to make a protest against Nebuchadnezzar? It's mind-boggling. But they could not comprehend the very nature of God that led these men to have such a commitment and such a conviction. But Nebuchadnezzar gives them a second chance. He says, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up?" Then he says, "Now if you are ready, at the moment you hear the sound of the horn, the flute, the lyre, the trigon," and there goes that list again. You just wonder why he sometimes didn't say, "in all that music." That repetition, again, I think certain mesmerizing effect, which probably is the way it was intended to be. This was a great ceremony that just psychologically intended to induce everybody to conformity and obedience, which is exactly the nature of much of our society. I want to tell you one of the things I always find unnerving when I see on TV pictures of rock concerts. I think about that when I think about all this. You think that, I don't think they had any rock musicians there, but I think about that in connection with this, because one of the things I always find very unnerving about that, if you ever watch those, you've got all of those thousands of people out there doing this. You know, they're all doing it in unison. And they all got this sort of glassy-eyed look, mesmerized, stamped into conformity, part of the great wave of humanity that bows before the God that is standing before them. But they don't do it. They are not mesmerized. They are not intimidated. I suspect they're terrified because they're humans. They know the step they're taking. And they know Nebuchadnezzar will do it. But they've made the choice anyway. Nebuchadnezzar's statement, "What God is there who can deliver you out of my hands?" Again, he can't get his mind around the idea of the God that they are talking about. He knows that there are lots of gods, but of course, if you've got lots of gods, they're all limited. There's no such God as a God who can actually overpower everything. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we do not need to give you an answer concerning this." I don't think, probably in the Hebrew, actually Aramaic right here, language, that was intended as a disrespectful statement. It is the nature and character of Daniel himself and his friends to be very respectful towards these monarchs. But he goes on to say, "If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the furnace of blazing fire, and he will deliver us out of your hand. But even if he does not, let it be known to you, O king, that we are not going to serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Seems to me that there are two or three points with which I'd like to kind of bring things to a close. First of all, they are looking at this large, in some ways kind of probably bizarre looking statue that has been raised, that they are supposed to worship and that everybody around them in wave after wave is falling down to worship. But we need to ask ourselves, not exactly what was the exact nature of that 60 by 6 statue. We need to be more concerned about what images our society sets up in front of us and says, "You must bow down to this to be a part of this society." What are the gods that our society holds up and says, "Bow down"? Or if doesn't command to bow down, entices us to bow down. And maybe we even need to ask ourselves, what are the gods that we might set up and bow down to? Whatever we serve, that is our God. Our God is not who we confess to be our God on the first day of the week. Our God is who we serve and bow down to the rest of the week. That's who our God really is. And this wasn't a church service that this happened. Another thing, I think we need to understand the inevitable collision course between the kingdom of God and the kingdoms of men. We have been blessed, most of us, to live in a country that was at least nominally a Christian country. We also see that turning, and turning very sharply in many directions, where Christian has come to be a term of derision in many elements of our society, and particularly when being a Christian is a matter of conflict with the state. I do not believe that democracy any more than Marxism or monarchies or anything else, is the ultimate answer to some peace and harmony and utopian world. Most people in the world are sinners. All people in the world are sinners. Most of the time, the world chooses the wrong course in spiritual matters. And the fact that we have been blessed to live in a democracy that has given us so much freedom and encouragement even in our faith is, in my view, probably not directly connected to it being a democracy, but a result of the fact that the people who were doing it were people of spiritual conviction. And when that changes, a democracy can become as powerful as any monarchy in crushing the faithful and the people of God. Another thing I think we need to learn, Satan knows. If he can't make you do everything, he can't really make you do anything. Conversely, if Satan can make you do one thing, he can make you do anything. Now, those might sound like even contradictory statements. But the key is what Satan makes us do. If ever people were under pressure where they might have said, I'm not doing it, somebody else made me do it. They might have said that. But Satan couldn't make them do that. And he knows that. And if he can't make them do that, he can't make them do anything. That doesn't mean they can't sin. But it won't be because Satan made them do it. On the other hand, if Satan can induce, seduce, tempt us to do one thing, he can ultimately seduce, tempt us to do anything. Because we've established the principle that given the right price, we'll sell out. It's just a matter of negotiating the price at that point. They would not sell out at any price. And what a wonderful encouragement. It is right that this is a lesson to present to our children, that they may stand when the time comes, that we may stand on their behalf and teach them to stand, because our God is able to deliver us. It may not be right now, but it will be that he will deliver us. We're going to stand and sing our song, He is Able to Deliver Thee. If you're subject to the invitation and ready to come and stand up for Jesus and bow down before him as your Lord, confess him, repent of your sins, and be baptized, we extend the invitation for you to come and make your desire to do that known while we stand together and sing.